This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Marriage is hard. Writing is hard. Writing with your spouse, easy as pie. On this special Valentine's Day episode, we'll hear from a panel of writers who tied the knot. Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver are best known for writing and co-producing the reboot of the Planet of the Apes franchise, including Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the sequel, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and its third installment, War for the Planet of the Apes, which was released in 2017. Jaffa and Silver are currently in production, co-writing Avatar 2 and 3 with director James Cameron. Cormac and Marianne Wibberly have been writing together since the early 1990s and are credited writers on films including National Treasure, National Treasure, Book of Secrets, and Bad Boys 2. Both couples recently sat down with Professor Fred Stripe at the Austin Film Festival to discuss the ups and downs, creative differences, and the different dynamic between married writing partners.
So, you know, this is not a panel on career advice to just go and sleep with your writing partner, but it sort of turned out that way for these folks. And I've always found it a little interesting to consider, I mean, with a divorce rate of 40 to 50% and the creative process and how difficult it can be that anyone can survive as a couple, as creative artists, is really kind of amazing. Could you just tell us how you met? And I know some people have heard this, but I'd like to hear it again, how you met and when you actually became a couple and how that worked. So we'll just go down.
All right.
You guys can jump in.
Cormac and I grew up in South Bay, went to the same high school. My girlfriend was dating a guy in his band, and she said, oh, Cormac would be really good for you to try to date because he's just like you. You guys don't like to go out and do anything. And so that's how we met. And then we ended up going to UCLA together, and he was working in Hollywood and as an executive, and I was in film school, and I just kept trying to get him to write with me because he would always give me really great notes, and he would always add a really great joke, and I was like, just write with me, and he wouldn't because
my dad was a writer, so he told me never do that, and I said, I'm not going to. I'm going to be a rock star. It's much easier.
It's better too.
Yeah. But anyway, she convinced me, and we started writing together, and we've been doing it for 20 some odd years. I don't want to name the exact number.
Ours is much more romantic than that. If you've got about an extra 25 minutes. We actually met Amanda's first night in Los Angeles. She'd moved out from New York.
Maybe you should. Well, she was giving you the eye, Rick, so maybe you should let her say
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was a receptionist for TriStar Pictures in New York, and I got a job on a desk being an assistant, so I moved here. And we moved to Los Angeles not knowing anybody, and Rick was an agent.
I was an agent.
Back in the dark ages, yeah. The dark times.
And so that first night, I was invited to a party by the woman I was replacing, and he was there.
Yeah. Really? I never knew.
Yeah, as it works out, she's from Texas, and she was a good friend of mine, and she said, hey, I'm having this party, and, you know. So anyway, we met her first night, and since I was an agent, I knew exactly what I was doing. We met the first night, but then we didn't see each other for like a year. But we're both in other relationships.
But we started writing together.
Right.
Later, we were already married, right?
Yes.
Wow. No,
well,
so
that's what I say, in a nutshell,
yeah.
I hated being an agent, but I represented writers, and I just, you know, I wrote a lot in college and everything. So I moved from being an agent to a studio executive, and that was a disaster. And the studio was going under and everybody was getting fired. So I started writing out of necessity. And Amanda was in film school. Is that right?
Yeah. I was in film school and I was kind of teaching you everything I was learning.
Yeah. So anyway,
but then
I started writing again.
And what point did you get married? After film school? Or
I was still in
during film school.
Oh, okay.
In so fact, my first script sold on our honeymoon. Oh. In fact, we were on our honeymoon.
And what was your first script?
It was never made.
Okay.
Yeah, it was called, yeah, it was called Hellbent and Back. It was like a...
Oh, that was actually a good script.
Well, thank you, Fred.
No, because now I remember that script. I think I've read it.
You've taught courses.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Hellbent and Back, because that was the script. And as you guys also had a script that you sold to Disney, and that didn't get made, but it kind of launched it, which is an interesting topic to talk about. And we will get into that whole process of what should your expectations be as writers. And by the way, this is about, you know, people who are writing partners who happen to be married, but I think it's about any kind of collaborative partnership. And I was going through some research again and found some interesting parallels that you have two women who went to film school and two loser guys who just couldn't get it together, but then were there and in the wings supporting the process, which was really kind of interesting. And then if you look at your careers, they're about 4 to 6 years oftentimes, and I'm not going to say who's older or not, but you actually have sort of like, I teased out phases of your careers, and they're sort of interesting. So I did think it was kind of interesting how these parallels have kind of formed. So there was the pre-6-day phase, I would say. Is that sort of accurate?
No, that's true. We sold a spec to Disney. We thought we had made it. And then you realize that that's not necessarily true if your movie doesn't get made. So you continue to write. And so we wrote the 6-day was when it really started. Actually, when we got Arnold Schwarzenegger attached, that's when everything changed. The movie still didn't get made for another year, but that really put us on an upward
trajectory. You talked about that yesterday. It was a fascinating story about how you wanted the everyman. It was Roger Thornhill or something from North by Northwest, and now it's Arnold Schwarzenegger playing this, you know, it's bigger than life thing. So, could I ask about Motel Blue? That was a film I didn't, or we can't talk about it.
No, I mean, it was just a film school thing that I don't think it's available, thankfully, anywhere.
Oh, so Garage Sale and Motel Blue were, okay. Those were back in the day, okay.
My God, I forgot about it.
No, that's... But
you guys could walk us through it.
Well, I could sort of walk you through it because everyone's sort of starting there.
Yeah.
So I was an executive at ABC in Saturday morning cartoons, and she was in film school, and she would be writing scripts, and she had won an award for this script. Mm-hmm. And it got optioned, but it got optioned like by some lawyer for a low amount of money. And they just kept, every year, they kept optioning it. And they kept optioning it. And you know, enough for we could go to dinner that night. And then, so that happened. And then after we started writing together and we wrote the spec script that sold at Disney, suddenly they decided, well, maybe we can get this made now. And so it was a script probably that was, I don't know, 10 years old or something. And so we, you know, did a quick rewrite on it, and they cast it.
Well, and then for Rick and Amanda, I feel like there was the, and this is a simplification, but, you know, the Hand That Rocks the Cradle collaboration, which I'm interested because you were an exec producer on that. Had you left the agency world and the production world?
Yeah, I had sold my first script.
Right.
So I was rewriting that when she finished Cradle.
He deserved credit on Cradle, and I begged him to take credit, and he wouldn't take it because it had been my thesis in film school, and so he felt like it started with me. It was really my script. But by the time it was getting made, he had done so much writing with me on it. He really did deserve credit.
If someone ever offers you credit on anything, take it. I had no idea. No, it wouldn't have been right to take. I mean, but to get back to your original question, it was how we started writing together.
Yeah.
It just kind of became natural. I was I sold it as a producer, sells things, but then it just kind of became a natural thing. We never really said, hey, let's just start.
Curtis Hanson was the director, and he was amazing, and he was an amazing mentor and teacher. We didn't know what we were doing, and so Rick would just join me, and we were answering notes and trying to get the movie made. It was the most natural thing in the world.
Rick, you had mentioned to me that you felt that you both did your best writing during those years in between The Relic and Rise of Planet of the Apes. So why don't we talk about that, where those years where you may not be on the radar in terms of the IMDb page, but that you're doing a lot of writing anyway.
One thing I should say about sleeping with your writing partner is that you're a one-income family.
That's right.
So it's not like one of us was a lawyer or a doctor. It's like you got to pay the bills with the writing. So it was it was stressful years, don't you think?
Yeah, I had told Fred this, but you know, the three scripts that did not get made, and you guys know, I'm sure you know this heartbreak, but you get right up to the finish or the start line. I mean, the train is ready to leave the station, and decisions that are made without a writer in the room derail the train. And by the third time it happened, you know, it's like that are you insane thing. If you just keep doing the same thing over and over. I swear those are our three best scripts. They're better than Rise. It's better than anything we've done. And it was heartbreaking. So then you kind of realize the capriciousness of the business. And the truth is, you know, I was out taking meetings, like, what else can I do for a living? And that's really, in one way, what gave birth to Rise, because we were just desperate. I mean, we were rewriting horror films and not putting our names on it and stuff like that for very little money, and basically conjuring that work up ourselves because our agents weren't into us anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we have exactly the same, like we could, like you said, we could say the same exact thing. We have scripts that were our favorites that made it to the end. We were getting directors attached, and then they do this tricky thing where they go, we love it, I want to do it. And then they get on board, and then they go, and I want it completely rewritten.
So, I just want to run it through my computer one time.
Or with my, you know, my writer friend, you know, whatever. And then it's like, oh, okay, everyone's excited to have the director, and then it goes into development hell for 2 more years. And maybe they do a good job and make a great script, whatever, but or maybe they don't. But it just, the momentum's there, and then it's not. And so, but you can't complain because you're lucky to have a job, and then you go on to do something else. And we have like 3 or 4 scripts that, we, you know, same thing. We feel like, oh, that's the one that got the way. And then on the side, yeah, you just do these other jobs and you're not getting credit, and then your IMDb page gets a little empty. Mm-hmm. And we had same things where agents, you're hot and cold, and right. It just, you know, after 30 years, it's just how it is.
So the pressure, though, that, you know, is on a writer in the business, you know, how do you then protect the relationship, or does the relationship help you protect the collaboration? Because it's a lot, you know, just to deal with the kinds of things you deal with as a writer, and then to also deal with the kinds of things you deal with as a couple, you know. So.
Yeah, and as parents, you know, because I still remember our career was taking off, and Sony wanted to pay us to go to Australia to do a quick production pass on a Go movie that was filming. And they wanted to pay us a lot of money, and we had a kid. And like you said, you don't have the other person that's the teacher or something at home that's holding down the fort, that so you can just get up and go. So we turned it down. You know, mm-hmm. That's because we were partners that are, you know, in our family too. So we couldn't do it. So there's certain types of work that we could take and that we couldn't take.
Can you articulate what you think is at the core of collaboration? I'm just curious. Do you have a thing that you can say? Okay, the heart of it is this. Being able to collaborate with someone.
Go ahead.
You said it yesterday. Respect.
I'd say that's the only way to have a writing partner is you have to be able to, you have to respect their work. And if you don't, it'll never work out. And we've seen that over and over again with writing partners that break up. They always go, oh, well, that, you know, the other person didn't really know anything. You're like, well, if you have that attitude, it's never going to work. I'm really impressed with Marianne's work. So when she does something, I'm like, wow, I'm lucky to have this. Mm-hmm. And it's always been that way for, I don't want to name the years, but, you know, I've been very lucky. And no day is easy. I don't have the answer to be like, oh, here's the key to successful marriage. I don't know what the answer is, even though we've been married for over 30 years, I couldn't tell you. There's good days and there's bad days, but you do respect and love that person, and that's the only thing that works for me.
Well, and you always are out of work, you know, at a certain point, right? You know, you sell something, it's great. Well, I guess we have to get back to work again, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a grind.
I think that's a great answer. I don't know that this supports that answer. I guess it supports it, but I would think just listening is is the key, really, with respect, but just really, really listening. And I think we continue to get better at that. And we'll be working, and you'll want to say something. You really want to contribute something, or you've got an idea. And even today, you know, we have a hard time like holding back and stopping ourselves. But then it's like, no. She's really smart. In fact, she's smarter than you are, so just sit there and listen. But no, just listen to one another. And I find that carries over into all kinds of things in our lives.
Well, the respect thing, too, is, you know, let's say you see a scene a certain way, and you're sitting down to write it, and your writing partner says, no, it's the other way. Or you're on the other guy coming in the room. You're not in the room when the scene starts. And even if you're very sure about your point of view, when you respect your partner and you've worked with them, you've put down so much track, that makes you say, well, wait a minute, maybe the way I've been seeing it is wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not an easy, you know, as a writer, you cling to those things you see, those things you know, you think you know. I think it makes the writing better and better if you're able to kind of challenge those preconceived notions you come in. They're almost like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a security blanket.
Mm-hmm. And it also helps articulate your point of view. like, geez, we've been together a long time, and yet we're still getting better at articulating our point of view on a specific idea or scene or character. And that really helps once movies start getting made. And then, because you're sitting there with the director or the actor, or even worse, you know, the studio executive, and you really get good at interpreting or communicating what your point of view is. And what's so funny, we've also noticed, like, for example, just say you've got a scene, and I've got this way, I see the scene working, and Amanda sees it differently. And we'll talk it out. We'll talk it out. Sometimes you talk it out for, I don't know, an hour or so. Sometimes an entire day, you sit there and talk. But the funny thing is that then you find yourself, we both have found ourselves in positions where we're articulating that point of view to someone else that wasn't ours to begin with. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's like I find myself saying, like, okay, Amanda was right. And then I find myself in a position defending it, articulating it, explaining it.
And that's why this listening is so important, and it does carry over into other pieces of collaboration, even with studio executives. But that idea of listening, I'm sure you do complement each other, but do you find, oh, well, I can do this really well and you can do this really well or whatever? Do you ever find yourselves falling into that, or is it this?
Yeah, I mean, we both do everything, but I do feel like Cormac is better at figuring out what the scene is really about. Like, he can really drill down on, like, what the theme is on. He thinks deeper than I do. I'm just saying. No, it's good. It's good. I'm really good at hammering out stuff. Like, he gets blank page terror. He just can't. It's hard for him to look at the blank page. So I'm really good at, like, if we talk out a scene, like you guys say, we know what the scene is, and we'll be, you know, walking our dogs, and we know what the scene is, and then we get into the house, and he's like, no, it's not going to work. And I'm like, just stop. I'm just going to do it. Let's just try it. Because, you know, once you look at it on the page, you can see. And that's just a craft thing. That's just me typing, him writing by hand, because that's where he gets his muse. I'm more unafraid to just make mistakes. I would say that's my special talent.
If there's a yin and yang, and I always say she's like a shark. She has to keep going. And if we're not writing something, if we haven't written 5 or 10 pages, she's very depressed, where I'm like, yeah, but we thought a lot. We come up with a scene, and I'm the one that's saying, oh, I don't know, maybe it's another way. And she's like, just let me just try it. And so she just plows the ground, and it's incredibly helpful. And then whether it's right or wrong, and she might say, and it might be one of those situations where, like they're saying, you're disagreeing with the scene. She's like, I think it goes this way. And I'm like, I know it doesn't go that way. I'm going to type it up. And by the end of the day, I'm like, God, it does go that way. You're absolutely right. So, when you do a slop draft, when you have a writing partner that does a slop draft, they have to have a superpower, because whenever somebody writes something, they're like, it's in stone. I wrote it. But the superpower is you take immediate notes and edits. And Marianne's able to, like, immediately, if I just start rewriting the whole thing, she doesn't start getting very sensitive about it. And that's a really hard thing to do.
Only about exclamation points.
Exclamation
you delete
points.
Them.
She likes exclamation points in dialogue.
Can I back up just a second, and then we can talk about who's got what strength. But I think one of the advantages of being married to your writing partner speaks to this very point Cormac brings up, is that if you're married, you don't really have that kind of emotional investment in what you've written. I mean, it's not as important when you've got your family at stake. You know what I'm saying? It's like there's just so much more at stake than a movie.
Oh, that's interesting.
And a written word. So, I mean, I wrote one other script with someone before Amanda and I started writing together. And there was a certain, like, you write something down, and there was a certain emotional flag planted saying, this is where, you know, and so if you're married, it's like, I think it's probably easier to say, no, you're right. It's you've got the right way. Let's go that way.
So what are your strategies? And I know, Rick, you had some rules you set up originally, but, you know, to kind of some ground rules and whether you actually hold to them or not.
We had rules we bring this up from time to time. We did have rules, and it's not even sticking to the rules. It's like, what's the spirit behind just having rules? You know, but one of them was we wouldn't bring things home. We would work, and then we wouldn't discuss them at the dinner table or whatever. And that's just impossible. It's just totally impossible. Yeah. But the idea behind it is that we'd have some kind of separation of church and state.
Right. You know?
No offense.
Or Episcopal, it's not. It's okay. Yeah.
And then one rule that I don't think we've ever actually done this, but we created something called veto power, which means that if it was an idea that Amanda had, like, for example, it was Cradle, is a good example. Start off as her script, you know, she'd done the first drafts and or the many earlier drafts and all that. But the idea was if it was her, it was a, her lead in the project, and we were arguing, she'd have veto power over an argument. Or if it's an idea that I'd had, I would have veto power. Right. I don't think we've ever, have we ever? I don't know.
We never really have.
Phrase, okay, goddamn it, veto power. That's my idea. Go to your room. You know, whatever. Well, I don't think we've ever done anything like that.
We were just scared because we were freshly married, and everyone was like, you guys are going to write together, and how does that work?
Do you guys get a lot of that?
People get very
people always say that.
Upset at the idea.
How can you do that?
Yeah,
but
how
in the beginning, though, because I think what you're saying is, like, in the beginning, we got a lot of, like, are you guys out of your minds? you just start getting started.
You guys were much more successful. Nobody ever even talked that.
Seriously, though, we had friends that were starting to retire, older friends that were starting to retire, and the spouses would say, I can't do it. I'm with them 24/7 now.
This is home.
And we're like, that's been our life, so it's going to be fine for us because that's what we do anyway. But about writing somewhere else, it's so funny because, like, we work so hard so that we can write at home. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the dream, right? So then when we got a job, so we sold we sold a show to Stars, and so we had a mini room, and so we had to drive to an office. And I still remember that first day, Carmack's like, we spent our whole life not having to go to the office. Why are we doing this? It worked out fine.
It's one of our arguments.
Well, let me ask the question then. So have you ever had that moment where, veto power or not, whatever your rules, regulations, that you really hit a wall between you? And maybe this is more like therapy now, but anyway. Which I think actually this, I think collaboration is a bit like therapy, and being able to talk things out and almost explaining it to yourself, to someone you trust, and then suddenly you go, yeah, actually, you're right about that, or I found something. But anyway, what, have you had one of those bang moments?
All the time.
Yeah, all the time.
Really?
I mean, yeah, all the time. That's what we were saying. It's just you learn every day, and you try to get better every day at working with your partner. And some days you think you got it, and then you run into that wall, and you're like, where did that wall come from? I didn't even see it happening. Mm-hmm. I thought we were past that. And you just go back to where you originally started, and you realize, okay, well, like you're saying, I got to listen, or then you just start changing your mind. But you do, you run into those situations. Like, it isn't going to be like, oh, it's free sailing, or you're writing with your partner, don't worry. But you are of one brain, as they were saying. You basically are one person, and that's the hardest thing.
Yeah. I would say that, again, if you're hitting a wall because you disagree on something, what we try to do is say, maybe my opinion isn't wrong. Maybe my version of the scene isn't wrong. Maybe it just needs a twist on the scene to make it work. So that happens a lot of times. He'll say, yes, but, you know, like, here's how. So that will often solve the problem. It's not that one of our ideas is wrong. We just didn't have that twist that made it right. But then there's also just the anger thing of just holding resentment. That's a different kind of wall. And that's something that when we were young, we would be like, how dare you not like my idea, and hold the grudge all the way through, you know. And then we just realized that that's just dumb. It's just a script, you know. Right. And we really did just, like, drop it. And we found that by dropping it, like, dinner time and next morning, and totally not even thinking about it until you clock in, it dissipates the resentment completely. You come in the next day and you're completely a different, you know, it's refreshed, and you may say, you know what, you were right. So those are two walls, different kinds.
Austin Film Festival's competitions are now open for entries. Film categories include both narrative and documentary shorts and features, comedy vanguard, dark matters, and animated shorts. Scripted categories include features, pilots, shorts, digital series, playwriting, and even fiction podcasts. Go to austinfilmfestival.com and submit before March 29th, the lowest entry fee for the year. For every established Hollywood producer, there are countless up-and-coming writers desperately trying to get their work read. Despite the odds of making it, these people continue to write. In our new podcast series, Toiling in Obscurity, we hear from working writers on their day-to-day obstacles and what keeps them inspired to keep writing. Ravati Damsi and Hector Lowe won the 2018 Austin Film Festival and the Josephson Entertainment Screenwriting Fellowship for their feature screenplay, The Death of Calm Cantor. They dated before becoming writing partners.
We spoke with the pair at the Austin Film Festival to discuss how they use their individual strengths to keep each other accountable as they continue pursuing their writing dreams.
So Hector and I met through a friend. We were actually partners before we became writing partners. So there was a little bit of a history before that. And then at some point, we decided to just start writing together. I think it started because in college, I had a capstone project that I really was, you know, slaving over and needed some punch-ups done, and Hector seemed like a cool guy.
So I came in and, you know, adjusted the dialogue, made it a little bit smoother and more sexy. That was our first real collaboration, and it was on a student film that went on to become our current contender this year, The Death of Colin Canter.
Yeah.
Began as a 15-minute brief, and now we've stretched it to a full feature.
And it's where we realized we were really good together as writers. Yeah. And so we decided to keep working with each other. Just kismet and then...
Yes, kismet. It's a very cosmic way of putting it.
Yeah. Exactly. Like I said, I work in children's animation. And before that, I was in feature development, actually. Live action feature development. And so a big part of that job is just consuming a lot of scripts. You read in, day out. Anything that comes across your desk, you read it. And I realized that the stuff I was reading wasn't very reflective of the content I wanted to put out into the world. It wasn't very reflective of like the truths that I saw around me. And so I realized it's like, hey, maybe I could be doing this better. And I always say that to my friends when they're like, hey, we really want to get in writing. I'm like, great, read a lot, because that's so important to know what's out there. And so in a lot of ways, I actually came from it from almost like a business standpoint, is that it came from a place of, hey, there's so many more important stories to be told out there, and like, let's find a way to get that in there. I guess if you want something done, you got to do it yourself. And so here I am writing.
I'm very different from Revati in that I don't come from a televisual background at all, or cinema. I went to university to study law and then later switched to literature because I thought, hey, I want to be a pedestrian when I grow up. I did a lot of reading, a lot of writing. I was always encouraged to pursue literature by my parents. And I didn't really understand or comprehend that writing for television or for cinema was even a job that human beings could have. That was sort of a closed book to me until, you know, one day you're watching the credits for 1,000 times on Batman Begins or whatever, and you go like, no, someone has to sit down and actually put the words on paper that get made into this great big thing that involves thousands of people and millions of dollars. And so the next year I moved to Los Angeles because I figured that was the best chance I had of being able to do that without much more than a wing and a prayer and a pen and paper. That was it.
I think that we are really attracted to genre pieces, but for me specifically, I'm really interested in telling stories of womanhood and exploring the different themes of womanhood through these heightened genres. And I think that that's definitely the connecting feature between all our work.
I would agree. When I think about the kind of stories that I am driven to tell, that we are driven to tell, both of us have something of an axe to grind in society. There are without going into detail, there are various social issues that really get us riled up. And a big part of our intent is to present them to people in a manner that isn't didactic, that isn't trying to bludgeon people over the head, because we both love to be entertained. We love pop culture, we love the Marvel movies, etc., etc. And there's no reason that a 19-minute film needs to be a lecture. So that's it.
Yeah.
We want to tell stories first and foremost, and hopefully stories with some meaning.
That cause change in a very subtle way. Yeah, right. I think that's really important, is just by organically weaving it through. Back when I was in college, this big thing that kept happening was either my identity was completely erased because they were like, cool, tell stories, but like, don't tell stories about yourself. Or that's not what we want to hear about. Here's what sells. And I'm like, cool, not really me. Or they wanted to completely make me a token. It's like, cool, tell us about the history of India. It's like, I don't like, I mean, yes, like I want to tell those stories, but that's not the only stories I want to tell. So I think it's really important that Colm was a Western. I feel like we want to find ways to organically weave the themes that are important to us through existing genres. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, take those existing genres like the Western that is so like pure American and elevate it to something new to like express the different perspectives that do exist in our world, especially in this country. Yeah.
Yeah. We want to tell American stories. America's more than just white guys. That says the white guy. America is more than just white men. And I think that means we have an equal claim to tell stories about people from all sorts of backgrounds without that being unusual,
yeah.
Without that being tokenism.
Exactly.
Like I don't want to use the phrase to normalize it, but sort of to normalize it. Why isn't that just standard?
Yeah.
When it comes to my writing routine, I have a few very solid principles that I try and abide by. Certainly, I'm accountable to Rave as my partner, so I'm not just writing for myself. You're writing to deliver to someone else. That accountability can be a strong motivating force. But when it comes to just self-discipline, one of my many key rules is what I call the two-minute rule. You ask why, where you find time to write. There is always time to write if you recognize that even doing the tiniest bit of writing in a day is a triumph in and of itself. So I have a two-minute rule. Every day, including today, I will write for 2 minutes. It doesn't matter on what and it doesn't matter how much. But knowing that you only have to write for the tiniest portion opens the door. You never just write for 2 minutes. It becomes 10, 20, 30, or 5 hours sometimes. But as long as you're writing a little bit every day, you don't have to look at that blank page and it doesn't become this intimidating edifice that you have to scale. It's just 2 minutes. 2 minutes adds up into a month, which becomes a 90-page, 100-page script.
And for me, it's so important that Hector is my partner because I'm the exact opposite of that. I'm like, put it in your schedule, like find the 2 hours a day to make this happen. And if you don't do those 2 hours, then you are a failure. So it's really nice to have a partner who is like, no, like increments are fine as long as you keep moving forward. So I think that if you choose to be a writing partnership, like find the partner that like complements your like weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really great way that we work out. I have a 9-to-5 job and I write before work. I get up really early. I'm up at 6 and then I write from like 6:30 to like 8:30 and then I'm at my desk doing my actual job. And so it's finding the time to do the things that are important to you. Mm. And so that's how I work. How we work together, it varies on each project. Death of Comb Cantor is not our only project out there. Like we've worked on more stuff since then. But I would usually say that sometimes it's me just, staying up for like 3 days straight and creating the skeleton of something and then like, collapsing in front of Hector and being like, here, I wrote 30, 40 pages. Take a look at it. I think it's the shape of something. And then being like, let me give it flesh.
Yeah, exactly. Skeleton and musculature. That's sort of, that's a broad.
And then we'll go back and forth. Mm-hmm. Other times we'll just, sit down, write it out actually through outline process together and then like workshop it there. So it really varies. I don't think that there is one certain way. It's just about being open to the other person.
It's true. Our process is, it's a flexible process, I'd say. But it generally starts with one person having a very passionate vision, saying, I want to write about this. And then you excite the other person so much that we go, yes, let us do that. Let's put that on paper. And the other person becomes like the facilitator, which is what happened with Colm. Rave said, I have this idea. I want to make it into a film. And I said, fine, I will help you do that. And on other projects, it's been the other way around. I've had an idea that I feel very strongly about, and she's been able to make me actualize that. That's the back and forth. Yeah, why keep writing? Why continue?
For me, it's literally because there's no other option. I would be like incredibly unhappy. I definitely have like tried to stop writing for a few weeks and it just doesn't happen. Yeah. Like I...
About 10 times a month, she'll text me and go like, this is terrible, I want to stop, what if we're bad?
Yeah.
It's that question a lot. Yeah. What if we're terrible?
And then I'll try to stop for a few minutes and then I'll be like, no, what am I thinking? I need to keep doing this.
There is that. Yeah. So there is that compulsive element that says as long as you've got another story inside you, you have to keep working to get it out. I mean, I think the thing that keeps me going personally is really it's the answer to that question. What if we're terrible? What if no one likes us? What if we never make it? I honestly believe everyone is a terrible writer. Every writer is a bad writer.
He does believe that.
I really do. Every writer is a bad writer. That's not to say that everything I read is bad. I read tremendous writing, brilliant writing, and I watch films with terrific scripts. What I mean is every first draft you write of something is garbage. It's just terrible. And you'll look at the last thing you made and go, that was so good. Why is this new thing? Why can't I get the characters to work? The structure is awful. Everything is terrible. But it becomes good because you keep working at it.
Yeah.
You can't stop because then it'll always be bad. Every writer is a bad writer. The good writers are the ones who take the bad writing and just hammer it and hammer it and hammer it like an iron on the anvil until it becomes beautiful and good. That's the only difference between a good writer and a bad writer.
I think Ira Glass has this really cool quote that I'm going to completely paraphrase and butcher, but the idea is that you have been developing your taste your entire life, whereas you have only been practicing your craft for a certain amount of time, like X years or what, X amount of years or whatever. So just by the nature of time and the way things work, your taste and your actual like practice in your craft will never sync up. So your taste will always be better than your craft. And that's just the way of life, and you gotta accept it. And so you will, like, you know, you keep working to bring those two things closer together, but like you will always have been developing your taste for longer. So what keeps me going? Literal unhappiness. It's that's it. It's the knowledge that if I don't do this, I will be significantly unhappier than if I do keep toiling away. You know, that's really it.
Yeah, similar. I continue writing because if I don't, I will never be good. It will never be great.
Yeah.
You can't win if you quit.
OnStory is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's OnStory project, including the OnStory TV series, the OnStory radio program, and the OnStory book series. Subscribe and download this podcast on iTunes. Follow us on social media at AFFOnStory and visit onstory.tv for more content. OnStory is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, and the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, Bita Kasimi, and Maya Perez. Our audio is recorded by Travis Kennedy, and our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music by Brian Ramos. Go to onstory.tv to watch, listen, and read more content from the Austin Film Festival and Conference. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's OnStory.